Great little boogie, that. It can almost be fantastic. Like a theme tune just to walk around to all day, isn't it? Nick Cave with the opening bars of Red Right Hand, a song better known to many of you as the theme tune to Peaky Blinders, which has just wrapped up its fifth series on the BBC, a show that regularly mixes fact and historical fiction to a certain degree. Donald Fallon is here, as always, for his usual hidden history slot, but you've picked it particularly, in a funny way, a contemporaneous one, because people who were tuning in last week would have seen the inclusion of Sir Oswald Mosley, who was the one-time leader of the British Union of Fascists. A lot of people might know the story of Mosley. The bit they might forget, though, is that after Mosley had been chewed up and spat out by British political culture, he then ended up shacking up in Ireland and appearing on The Late Late Show.
It's an extraordinary tale.
Which is bonkers.
And it shall never be seen on Reeling in the Years or in any documentary on The Late Late Show, because as we'll get into later on, the tape is conveniently gone.
So we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes' time. First of all, let's talk about Series 5 of Peaky Blinders. Reviews have been mixed, but this character in particular has been praised.
First of all, it's a joy to watch anything on BBC because there's no advertisements during the programme, which I think is incredible. And it really gives this show a kind of cinematic feel when you get to watch an episode through in its entirety. But, you know, Series 5 has not received the kind of the rave reviews of Series 1 to 4. And I think Sam Claflin's depiction of Oswald Mosley was one of the saving graces off the show. And for the four people in Ireland that aren't familiar with the programme, maybe someone is listening who's never seen an episode of Peaky Blinders. It's this great show concerning the Shelby family gang, based on a real life gang of late 19th, early 20th century Birmingham, known as the Peaky Blinders because of the flat cap uniform of the gang. And, you know, any city that was worth its salt had its own variation of the Peaky Blinders. In Dublin, in the 1930s and 40s, it was the Animal Gang. But these gangs kind of evoked fear in people right across these islands. But to be honest, the name and the style is all that the BBC show has taken from that particular real-life gang. Mm. What has been interesting for historians has been the other kind of real-life characters and organisations that have come in over the various series. So we've had, you know, early 20th century Jewish London gangsters. The IRA have made an appearance as well. The lines between fact and fiction have often been very blurred in the show.
Okay, and then I suppose, given the time that the show was set in, this kind of between the wars period of the 20s and 30s, then it's sort of understandable that someone like Mosley, who was prominent at the time, would end up featuring.
You couldn't tell the story of Britain between the wars, you know, without pulling in this character. And his ability to mobilise the masses, both in support and in complete opposition, was, you know, without precedent. Mosley could bring 40,000 people onto one street in Britain, 20,000 there to hear him speak and 20,000 there to stop him speaking. But he's remembered as the founder of the BUF, the British Union of Fascists, thundering in 1938 that in Britain we have lit a flame that the ages shall not extinguish. Guard that sacred flame, my brother Blackshirts. Let it illuminate Britain and light again the path of mankind. By comparison to, say, Ono Duffy and the Blue Shirts in Ireland, this was something different entirely. You know, Mosley was a very, very capable fascist leader, someone that was respected by Mussolini, Franco and the vanguard of fascism.
Tell us about his political journey, just for people who aren't entirely familiar with the journey of Oswald Mosley. He went on a slightly strange political journey because of the different parties that he ended up being allied to.
An amazing journey from conservative to Labour, and I mean the far left of Labour, a Labour radical, to fascist. And, you know, it's somewhat surprising. He's the youngest conservative MP in Westminster's history. And then in 1922... Oswald Mosley walks across the floor and he joins the rank of the Labour Party. And he has World War One experience. That's really vital for political reputations in 1920s Britain. That's something that's touched on in Peaky Blinders as well. Thomas Shelby, the main character, is a World War One veteran.
What leads him to leave the Tories then?
Incredibly, one of the reasons he walks away from the Tories is his horror at the abuse of power that is the Black and Tan Terror in Ireland. And Mosley says that the name of Britain is being disgraced. Every rule of good soldierly conduct is disregarded. Every decent instinct of humanity outraged. So it's difficult to believe that the father of British fascism walked away from the Conservatives because he was angry at the Black and Tans in Ireland. But that's exactly what happens. And when he goes into the Labour Party and is a Labour MP in a Labour government, you know, he's very socially radical. And I think today, his positions on employment, on state nationalisation of industries, they might use the word Corbyn. You know, he would be on that wing of the party. But when he drifts from Labour and when he loses faith with the left, you know, it's the emerging politics of the continent that appeal to him, the language of Mussolini. And remember, Mussolini is a former communist himself. So this trend, this rise of the right in Europe kind of sparks something. And a former Labour MP, you know, he is the unlikely poster boy for British fascism. But so it was to be. And the Black Shirts, the British Union of Fascists, would captivate an awful lot of people in their infancy.
Okay, talk to me about the role of the press in helping to sort of bring him to prominence, because obviously they're the similar people who you might argue have similar leanings today who have become press darlings in some quarters of the British newspaper publications. Similar stuff for Mosley as well.
Yeah, but it's easy to kick the Daily Mail all the time. But I mean, some of the papers that came out on the side of Mosley are quite surprising. The Daily Mirror, which traditionally was considered a more left-leaning newspaper, was also sympathetic enough in the early stages. But the enthusiasm of the Daily Mail was quite remarkable and terrified kind of other conservatives. So the Spectator magazine went as far as to say the black shirts, like the Daily Mail, appeal to people unaccustomed to thinking. The average Daily Mail reader is a potential black shirt ready-made. But even the Daily Mail eventually moves away from Mosley, because the violence at the British Union of Fascist rallies are just incredible. And the language that Mosley starts using moves into this kind of realm of just unhidden anti-Semitism, which by 1935 is intolerable even to a lot of his earlier supporters. I mean, the stuff he's saying, it's like it's out of the protocols of the elders, you know, of Zion. He talks about the Jewish interests in this country commanding commerce, commanding the press, commanding the cinema, dominating the city of London, killing industry with their sweatshops. These great interests are not intimidating and will not intimidate the fascist movement of the modern age. So it's the same anti-Semitic trope that's being, you know, put out by people like Goebbels in Germany. And it becomes harder and harder for the respectable mainstream press to stand by Oswald Mosley.
Is that what drives people then away, the idea that he's parroting some of the same stuff that you're hearing from totalitarian regimes on the continent?
And the fear that if you go to an Oswald Mosley meeting, you know, you might come home in a wheelchair. The inability of Mosley to organise on the streets of Britain, I think, is one factor in people walking away from him. And the violence is unbelievable. The British Union of Fascists, I mean, they're essentially a paramilitary. They're more than willing to dish out violence. But there's also other people that are opposed to them. So when they have this great meeting on London's Cable Street, which is a very provocative idea, like Cable Street was a largely Jewish district, sizable Irish community in it as well. The Jews and the Irish in London didn't particularly get on, but they found enough common ground to mobilise together and stop Mosley's men marching through their district. The violence that day was unbelievable. And often it's conservatives that are most hostile to Mosley. The conservative government of Churchill play a big part in his decline. During World War II, they kind of isolate him, they imprison him, and they outlaw the organisation. So from the left, you know, from the Irish Dockers of the London Union movement to Churchill, there's a broad realisation that Mosley is dangerous.
So World War II happens and concludes, obviously. Mosley is a bit of a beaten docket politically. He becomes something of a nomad and then ends up over here.
And he wanders around kind of, he spends most of the rest of his life living in Paris, but there's this really curious period of several years in the Ireland of the 1950s where he's here. And he seems to have caused very little, you know, general interest. The newspapers don't seem to have picked up on the fact Mosley was here. He lives in Galway in this beautiful kind of stately home, which is eventually burnt out. And at the time, what's said in the press, and Mosley himself pushes this, is that this was an accidental fire. The passing of time has revealed that it was anything but. It was a very deliberate act, and that some people in Galway were unhappy to have Mosley kind of living in their ranks. But on occasion, he pops up in the newspaper archives. Like, he speaks in Trinity College Dublin at the Phil. He takes part in the debate. And this is still something that happens all the time. You know, university societies invite some controversial speaker on campus. Well, it was Mosley in the 1950s. But, you know, any attempt to kind of put himself back into British politics failed abysmally. And it seems, looking at the MI5 files in London and the special branch files in Dublin, they knew he was here, but they took very little general interest in him.
So talk to us then about what we mentioned at the very top of the show, is that someone who was, you know, the founder, or really the figurehead of British fascism between the wars, somehow in the 1970s, don't know whether he's still even resident in Ireland at the time, but he ends up as a panellist on The Late Late Show.
Yeah, and as you said at the beginning, incredibly, this footage is gone. This will never be seen. Bar someone has a copy of it at home, and if they do, please get in touch with me, because I'd love to, I'd love to see it.
To get
it online would be fantastic. RTE claim it was recorded over. That's not totally uncommon, that there are gaps in the RTE archive, things that are gone in the pre-digital age. But it's this really weird moment in Irish television history, because there's a lot of debate going on in 1970s Ireland over who should be allowed on television and who shouldn't. You know, Section 31 was in place, which kind of greatly restricted the access of both Republican and kind of loyalist paramilitaries to the airwaves. So The Late Late Show in the 1970s is at the height of its power. I mean, it's been on air since 1962. It's, even then, it's a long established institution. I think it might be the longest running TV chat show
in the English speaking world,
which is extraordinary, absolutely amazing.
It's basically been around as long as RTE have. So then, even if Irish broadcasting or TV broadcasting is only 15 years old at the time, it's been there from day one.
And I mean, what's more entertaining than watching The Late Late Show these days is watching Twitter respond to The Late Late Show.
Well,
it's fantastic.
Had Twitter been around in 1975, I'd say there probably would have been quite a lot of opprobrium around Mosley being on The Late Late, because certainly the mainstream press at the time it seems, were far from impressed.
Yes, in the absence of the Twitterati, you know, it falls down to the press to condemn this. And the condemnation is absolutely incredible. There's a letter of denunciation signed by students in University College Galway, NUIG to us, which criticises Gay Byrne for, quote, your light-hearted approach and your interrogation of Sir Oswald Mosley, which will be better suited to a retired Hollywood star of the silent movie age. And not having this footage, I mean, the only way we can get a picture of what happened on that show is by reading the newspaper reports. One letter writer in the Evening Herald praises the people in the audience who challenged him and said, I can corroborate the words of that courageous Jewish young lady. Warmest congratulations to her and to the man who spoke up. So Mosley didn't get a totally easy ride of it from the audience when he was on the show. But there was definitely horror, you know, in sections of the press that he had also previously lived in this country.
Many people probably only just drew attention to the fact that he had previously lived in Galway.
Totally unaware that the leader of the British Union of Fascists had been swanning around, you know, the west of Ireland. So, you know, this is, in the history of the Late Late Show, it's an important moment, but it's a moment that's gone forever.
Yeah, in truth though, and this isn't to try and presume the logic of the Late Late Show at the time, but by 1975, at the time he would have been treated, perhaps as a curiosity, it was because, politically speaking, he was a spent force.
He was, and I mean, if you wanted to walk around post-war Ireland, there were other strange characters you could find. I mean, there were Croat and Breton collaborators of the Second World War who ended up living in this country and became, you know, part and fabric of society here. The artist Jan Goulet, other people, I mean, people that had collaborated with fascism during World War II and became accepted parts of Irish society. And I think, to be honest, many TV producers, perhaps innocently, may have viewed him as just a historical curiosity. And now he's a historical curiosity to a much younger audience, thanks to Peaky Blinders. But I think what they've managed to do in this programme brilliantly, and they didn't manage to do much brilliantly in season five, but they did this brilliantly, they captured what Mosley was once upon a time. You know, a man who was ready for power and who millions of people had faith in and who believed they would live to see a fascist Britain.
Yeah, but at least done in a way that doesn't necessarily glamorise or sort of attract attention to or support for that cause as well, which
Absolutely.
Is always a very delicate job. If you do happen to have footage at home, whether you've got your old Betamax machine out that was taping the Late Late Show in 1975, do get in touch with Donald Fallon via the Come Here To Me blog, which he's the creator of. You can also buy his books, the Come Here To Me blog, Come Here To Me books, volumes 1 and 2 of which are available in all good bookshops now. Donald Fallon, as ever, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.